morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Barbara Goldman and Carol Horowitz, talking about the wonderful subjects of sexual assault and domestic violence and things like that, but and all the good things going on in that world as well. And right now, I would like to welcome Malka Drucker. She is a rabbi of the Hamakom Congregation, the place for passionate and progressive Judaism. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And you are here on the occasion that Thursday is Holocaust Remembrance Day, Yom HaShoah. What is that day? Has it been going on for a long time?
Actually, it hasn't. Obviously, it did not begin until after World War II. And it began in the 60s. However, it's a relatively new commemoration, and it is still in evolution. And some congregations fast on that day. Others hold an observance of complete silence. Our congregation does a combination of both, and we do readings. In this case, this year, we're doing readings from German Jews writing to their American relatives during the 30s of what was going on in Germany.
So there's fasting, there's events such as you're mentioning. How is it celebrated in Israel? That's a place where it's also a big day, I take it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's not celebrated.
Maybe celebrate is the wrong word.
Observed. In Israel, the Holocaust is a somewhat controversial subject among Jews, because all subjects are controversial among Jews. There's always 12 opinions on any one. But this one particularly, there's nothing redemptive about the Holocaust. Every other Jewish holiday that's observed was one where Harry was small and we fought back and we survived. This is one where we were nearly obliterated in the memory and witness of those who are still alive. So for many, to keep it in the past and not to mark it at all was very much part of the energy of the time. And then there were others saying, no, there are too many who were borne witness. Israel itself was created in the ashes of the Holocaust. The population was Holocaust survivors. So there was a great controversy about how to mark it, because there was a feeling that they wanted to emphasize the new muscular, successful Judaism of the Israeli pioneers, and those who came out of the camps who weighed 85 pounds were not part of that picture. So it's over these years it's been integrated that, look, this is part of our psyche. I mean, if you want to understand Israeli politics today, you have to know something about what happened 60 years ago.
So it's interesting. We were talking before we went on the air about how is there not something redemptive about the Holocaust? I mean, you wrote this book called Rescuers, Portraits of Moral Courage in the Holocaust, and rescuers are those very tiny percentage of people who actually saved hundreds of thousands or one person from death during the Holocaust. How did you come to write that book?
I wrote the book because I felt that the Jewish community needed to heal from the trauma and the hemorrhage of the Holocaust. It was enough that we lost 6 million. But to lose the spirit of future generations because of its rage and fear and suspicion would be the ultimate victory to the Third Reich. So I felt that when I began to find out, because of my rabbi, Harold Schulweis, that there were such people. I mean, I knew about Anne Frank, but I had no idea that there was anyone who brought her food over those years. So suddenly now there was beginning to be information in the early 80s. And part of the reason was,
you knew about Anne Frank, but you didn't, I mean, it's
about
all
her
in
rescuers.
But it's all in her diary.
About the rescuers? Yes, that's right. That's true. But you see, it was one of those voices that the Jewish community couldn't hear in its horror. They could only hear one side of it. But my rabbi felt very strongly, because he had children of his own, said, how will I tell them about the Holocaust? How can I tell them about this horror if I don't have a bit of light to pierce that darkness? And then he actually met two young Jewish men who were graduate students at Berkeley and said, we're looking for someone who hid us in Warsaw in his house for 4 years. And then Schulweis began to investigate and found that there were, in fact, tens of thousands of rescuers. That being said, Mary Charlotte, I always feel that I have to say that with the 10,000 that we know, there were tens of millions who stood by. So that even though I've written a book that's very handsome and it's got these wonderful pictures in it and it tells wonderful stories, I always feel that this is sacred memory and that we have to remember that they were a teardrop in an ocean of indifference, the rescuers, and they represent the glory of the human spirit, yet historically they would not deserve more than a paragraph in a book about Holocaust.
We're talking to Rabbi Malka Drucker. Well, what do you mean they wouldn't deserve more than a paragraph? I mean, in history is the story of heroes and great people, not the story so much of ordinary people.
That's true, but it's also the story of villains. And in this particular story, in terms of numbers, that's all that I'm speaking. I'm saying their deeds are without measure, yet if we're counting their significance historically and the number that they saved versus the number that perished, that's all I'm saying.
Well, and you can look at virtually any society, including our own today, and look at the number of people standing by when about what's going on. You know, choose your genocide, Darfur, or choose your war, Iraq, whatever it is, and most people are going about their daily business.
I'm very glad you mentioned that. I mean, one of the things that Gabe Block and I, who worked on, we did this together, discovered is that there were four parts to play in the war. There was the rescuer, there was the perpetrator, there was the bystander, and there was the victim. And then when we left the work to sit with it, we realized that those four parts play in everyone's life every day. I mean, God forbid we should live in a time that requires heroic rescue. Yet this first steps of that, invariably, is to have your eyes open to what's going on around you. So that the tens of millions who stood by are the bystanders versus the tens of thousands who were rescuers. You're absolutely right. That's why Elie Wiesel, a survivor himself, was one of the first voices to protest the lie, because he said, if not me, then who will speak out? Who else knows?
What were some of the qualities that you saw in the rescuers? I mean, I think one of the things that happens to me, this is the second book that I've read about rescuers. We had somebody on a couple of years ago who'd written a book specifically about Dutch rescuers. And what you can't help but wonder when reading these stories is, what would I do myself under the circumstances? What were some of the qualities in the people that you saw who were rescuers?
Again, I mean, it's a wonderful question. If you look at the jacket of the book, you see many faces on it. And Gay and I did this purposely because the biggest question is exactly the one that you ask. Would I have done this? There's a worse question, Mary Charlotte. What am I doing now? The qualities of a rescuer, first of all, as I said, is you have to have your eyes open. I mean, we met people who were for the most part poor, old, sick, living in obscure places in the world. They knew everything that was, the whole world was their neighborhood. They were, in Yiddish the expression is a kochleffel, which is a cooking spoon that's in every pot. And my sister was always called the kochleffel, she was in everybody's business. Rescuers were holy kochleffels. The whole world was part of their domain. They lived, everybody mattered to them.
So they were internationalists as opposed to nationalists.
And universalists.
Universalists.
And they also had a healthy degree of nonconformity. They were part of a society, and yet they were very independent. They had, you could almost say, to use the metaphor, an allergy to injustice. You might not like it, I might not like it, they could not bear it. They could not stop themselves from doing what they were doing. If you spoke to them, maybe this is one of the marks of heroes, and you said, what you did was heroic. What was heroic? I thought that they were speaking humbly about themselves. No, they were pointing a finger, as I felt it, at me, which is, don't call me a hero. You call me a hero, you put a halo on my head, you exempt yourself. What are you doing now in your life? And that really was, to me, the question that the rescuers asked again and again and again, that why are they important beyond the Jewish community? Why are they important beyond this generation? Because they represent a certain behavior that is the highest we can expect of a human being morally. And why they did it is a mystery. Some would say a miracle. And I'm not sure what it is. You can only pray that you live a life that prepares you to do the right thing when the moment demands it.
Can that, do you think, be taught or learned?
It's a great question also. We went to a number of seminars of that very question. The social scientists looked for patterns. In the early 80s, they began to look for this population to see, since they were all, by definition, altruists, if there were commonalities that could be applied for future generations to teach altruism. And some would say, yes, that if the cat jumps on the table and you throw the cat to the floor, you're teaching a three-year-old behavior towards the other. But if there's much more of a sense of everything is an opportunity for teaching reverence for other living things, it can make a difference. Marion Pritchard, one of our rescuers, a psychoanalyst in Vermont, said to us, someone has to use that dirty little word, sacrifice, for a child, to stay home with a child, teach what sacrifice looks like. So some would say yes. Gay and I, on the other hand, not as scientists, but as artists, creative people, looked at these people, saw anti-Semites here.
So among the rescuers?
Among the rescuers, who would say, when you say, you know, why did you do this? And they say, you know, I don't like Jews necessarily. I would have done this for an Eskimo. I would have done it for a cat. Some of them said, how did you hide this person? You know, was it difficult to hide this person? Difficult to hide him. He looked like 10 Jews. So there was, you know, there were all these sort of unconscious, it didn't matter. But you were really sensing, again, that universal empathy for the other again and again and again.
There are so many different ways that people rescued others. One of them was the typical, the story that we know from Anne Frank, which is hiding somebody in your house, making a false wall. There was one person who you have written about more extensively, which is a boy who they hid under the sink. They made a false floor in the sink, and then they moved and they hid him in the couch while they were moving. But then there are other people, like a Portuguese diplomat who was barred from issuing visas to Jews, and he issued 10,000 visas anyway. When he went home, he was ostracized and died poor and unknown.
The stories range from somebody hiding someone for a half an hour to these amazing, I mean, you know, one woman spoke to us about having a very boring woman stay with them for years. And could you keep her in the basement, or would you have dinner with her every night? You think about having a house guest. You think after 4 or 5 days, you begin to grow weary of it. So imagine these dilemmas, or you have someone staying in your house and they say, you know what, you can have this brilliant writer and a political dissident stay in your house, but you only have room for one rescuer whose life is worth more. So these dilemmas of people who had children, one of the most poignant stories, Art and Yocha Voss had small children. Their 5-year-old would go to the bus stop. She would have a note in her pocket from one of the resistance people in Holland, in Amsterdam. And I mean, when I heard this story, I said, my God, you know, you risked your children's lives to do this? And Yocha looked at me and her eyes flashed and she said, we did it because we had children, so that they would know what it was to be a human being if it was the last thing we did.
We're talking to Rabbi Malka Drucker. It's funny, about the word 6 million, because more than 11 million people died in the Holocaust, and you often hear 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. Well, over 5 million Gentiles died in the Holocaust. Are they part of Holocaust Remembrance Day, Yom HaShoah?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the great intentions of remembrance, Mary Charlotte, is not just as a Jew, but it's to commemorate intolerance, it's to commemorate cruelty, because it's only by remembering these things that we might avoid it in the future. We just celebrated Passover, and I remember that a black minister said to my rabbi, Harold Schulweis, "Why is it that you people, three times a day, speak about your slavery in Egypt, this shameful, painful time?" And Schulweis said, "Look, by remembering three times a day what happened to us, it will keep our eyes open to what's happening to others in the world. If Jews only remember Jews on Yom HaShoah, then we failed in our teachings, because this is a teaching of love, and it's a love for all."
But, I mean, I think that happens all the time. I mean, you so often hear 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. You rarely hear 11 or 12 million people died in the Holocaust.
It depends upon who's counting. It depends upon who's remembering. I will tell you how many died in my family, how many died in the family of humanity. Who is counting the others? I mean, that's not entirely true. I mean, I've been to exhibits of the persecution of homosexuals during the Holocaust, of gypsies as well as others. When, God forbid, I should lose a child, there's not a mother I could look at in this world that I don't know that we're sisters in our sorrow. So when I remember 6 million who died in my family, and I look at another, when I met rescuers who lost siblings, who fought with them in the resistance, I know that we're brothers and sisters in this.
Now, you've written a children's book, you've written or are writing a children's book?
Yes.
It has come out, called Jacob's Rescue. Tell us story of Jacob.
Yeah. Jacob's story was that he was a little boy in Poland. He had two brothers. He was living in the Warsaw Ghetto. The men in his family thought the Germans were such civilized, cultured people, they would never harm women and children. So the men left because they felt that they were endangered, and they left the women and children. So there was Jacob with his aunt and grandmother in the Warsaw Ghetto. Alex Roslin did business with Jews because he sold fabric.
He was a non-Jewish Pole.
He was a non-Jewish Pole. And he had two children of his own. And one day, one of his friends, who was a driver for Jacob's family, because his family is very wealthy, said, "Listen, I know about this family that just wants to protect their three children. Is there anything you can do?" Alex said, "Well, I don't know." And he said, "Well, listen, let me take you into the ghetto to see what it looks like." Alex goes into the ghetto. Immediately he sees a child who is just, he's starving to death. Alex reaches into his pocket to give him a cracker, and the man who takes him in says, "Don't give it to him. He'll be dead by nightfall. Let him go in peace." It's a capital crime to go into the Warsaw Ghetto. Alex is intrepid. He sees this, he comes out shaking, and he says to his wife, Mela, "We have to do something." And Mela says, "What can we do? Thousands are dying every day." Alex says, "We can save one." They ultimately take the three boys into their house. Jacob's Rescue, which is for children 9 to 13, describes the dynamic of their boy, who has always hated Jews and bullied them, and the Jewish boy, Jacob, now trying to deal with somebody he's terrified of, sleeping in the same bed. Ultimately, one of the children dies of the three. Jacob survives. His brother David survives. They were loved and they were protected by Alex and Mela. We had the great blessing of meeting the rescuers. And in fact, just a year and a half ago, we were in Israel and we had lunch with Jacob and David.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did they participate in the making of the children's book that you wrote?
Very much so. But I'll tell you a funny story, because every survivor, of course, wants to tell his story. And Jacob always had a fantasy that he would write this book himself. So I interviewed him extensively and his brother. And then I wrote the book and I sent it to him in 1993. And I never heard from him. And in 94, I went to Israel, and I got in touch with him. And before I sat down in his house, he said, I didn't like the book, but you changed my mind. 6 months before, I had sent him a packet of letters, because I get several times a year, I could still get packets of letters from classrooms. This was from Nova Scotia. They'd never seen a Jew, let alone heard of Holocaust. And these kids had read Jacob's Rescue. And they responded, you know, with so much sympathy, so much empathy, and so much understanding of what this, of the heroism, of the horror, of the sadness, that Jacob, in reading those letters, said, well, if this is how you have to tell the story to teach it, then this is the way.
So at first he didn't like it because he felt it wasn't true to life?
Yeah, it wasn't his story. Who are these people? You know, of course. I mean, I was doing the best I could.
But you weren't there and all the details. Right, right, right. So another question that comes up whenever one discusses the Holocaust is the question of forgiveness and what does it mean to both remember and to move on in your life with some sense of peace in your own heart.
Well, those are two different things, forgiveness and moving on, I've decided. It's a wonderful question. There's a book I'd recommend called The Sunflower by Simon Wiesenthal, where he asks dozens of people this very question, Desmond Tutu, Dalai Lama, etc. He gives them a little scenario that had happened to him. In Judaism, the word forgiveness is sacred. You forgive anyone who comes to you and asks forgiveness. And if you refuse them after they've asked you three times, you're greater than the sin they committed.
Your sin is greater than their sin.
So say in the reconciliation hearings that we saw in South Africa in the 90s, this was a situation where one party was asking forgiveness of the other. Say in the case where there is a forgiveness that's given, say in Rwanda, it's a forgiveness that has to be given or you destroy it. That's a letting go and moving on. So in the case of the Holocaust, who can forgive? Who can offer forgiveness? To whom? Can I forgive a Nazi for what they've done to another? I would say no. I would say no. Does the Jewish community collectively have responsibility? Yes. I think the Jewish community has great responsibility to honor the rescuer, to honor those who not only saved so many, but also saved the honor of humanity. Part of, again, our, it's not forgiveness, but it's a matter of the more we speak what these people did, we're not only speaking about the individual rescuers, but we're also offering a model for future generations of what can happen. For those who committed the atrocities, only those to whom they committed it could offer forgiveness. Who else could offer it?
Well, it's interesting that you tell the story that somebody has to ask forgiveness three times. I mean, when you look at the post-Holocaust literature, both German, you know, whether you want to call it guilt literature or whatever, all the movies and all the books that have come out saying, look at what we did, and then all the Holocaust survivor literature, right, talking about the horrors of it and talking about it in so many ways. I used to be sort of obsessed with it and would read book after book, and they were all so different in the way that they approached, even though you'd see in the books the same camps and the same phenomena, that the perspective that each of these people brought to it was so different. And so on. So with the German literature, there is kind of on a, you know, media, book, literature, movie, article level, a kind of, it seemed, maybe it's waning now, but after World War II, sort of this massive, you know, asking for forgiveness and saying, here's what happened, that went on a cultural level between Germany and the Jewish diaspora all around the world.
Well, you know, I have to say I'm not so knowledgeable, you know, of the whole history of the response of this. I know it better, you know, face-to-face, one-on-one. I know that Holocaust, I can't think of the producer now, it came out in the 70s. That was phenomenal because Roots really shifted a whole generation in Germany to look at it really for the first time, in a way.
Now, what, Roots?
Not Roots, Holocaust.
Okay. That was, what is it, a TV series?
Gerald, yeah, you don't know. Like, no. That really, I think in the early 70s, here in the United States, and then a travel to Germany, that opened up a whole popular consciousness. I mean, the intellectual community sort of had its own thing going on. But what I see is that between, when Gay and I went to Germany in 1988 to interview German rescuers, who to me are the most heroic, because they were not only rescuers, but they were also traitors to their country. So those people, for the most part, those rescuers were just, I mean, you never, like Gita Bauer, who you said, saved only one. And when the Israeli ambassador said to her, but that one had children, and now there are grandchildren, so you save more than that. Whoever saves a single life saves a whole world. That still, many people in Germany, including the translator we had in Berlin, there was a great feeling by then in 1988, like, get over it, to Jews. So then you're sitting there in a place where you have to get over it on some level. This was one of the ways I got over it, because I broke my own stereotype every time I heard German, because now I had a face like Gita Bauer's, or Maria von Maltzahn, a veterinarian who saved hundreds in her Berlin apartment, and we went to visit her in that very apartment.
Wow.
There's a movie Jacqueline Bisset was in, where she starred in, I forgot what it was called, The Last Jew, I thought, or something like that.
We're talking to Rabbi Malka Drucker. So our time is drawing to a close right now, but Holocaust Remembrance Day is Thursday, Yom HaShoah. What are you doing to observe this day, and when are you doing it?
Wednesday night, April 30th, at 5:30 at St. Bede's, which is at San Mateo and St. Francis, we are having Yom HaShoah observance. We have a great number of people in our community who are children of survivors. So it's a paradoxical moment. On the one hand, we're still here. On the other hand, we also look at how Holocaust has marked all of us, so we'll be reading letters from German Jews to their American relatives in the 30s asking to get out. We also have a member of our community, Naomi Fisk, who is a therapist who uses the Hellinger method of therapy, which has its root in families that have survived the Holocaust and seems to apply in many other places. So we invite anyone in the community who would like to see what the observance is, where we light candles, and we remember all those, including those heroic non-Jews who reminded us that even though institutions do not have souls, people do.
Rabbi Malka Drucker, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And by the way, the number for more information is 992-1905. We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. And I would like to welcome Barbara Goldman. She is the director of the Santa Fe Rape Crisis Center and Trauma Treatment Center, Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center, and Carol Harwitz, who is the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Liaison for the City of Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
Great to have you, ladies. And this is National Sexual Assault Awareness Month, where it's coming to the end of this month, but there's a lot going on. 12 months a year, not just during this month.
That's right.
Let's talk about the Santa Fe Rape Crisis, which has now more words in its title, Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center.
Correct.
Why did you expand the name? I mean, it's been expanded for some time, I guess.
Well, we've been around for 35 years, and over those 35 years, we have managed to learn to take the pulse of the community and found that there were so many citizens here who absolutely were suffering from trauma, and there were very few places to go. So we, in fact, decided that we needed to do something about that, and so we've expanded our services to include all forms of trauma, not just that associated with sexual violence. And specifically, we were looking at veterans, and we were looking at first responders. And you talk about a cohort.
First responders being what? Firemen?
EMTs, nurses, anybody who's first on the scene, firefighters, all of those folks.
Police officers.
Police officers. Thank you, Carol. Exactly.
And so what if somebody is, we'll get to the first responders in a moment, but let's say somebody is assaulted, man or woman, boy or girl, what can they do? What's the first thing that they can do?
Well, let's divide those. Let's divide those into children and adults because there's separate criteria for both. Let's start with children. First of all, children who have been sexually violated, we need to teach them to understand what sexual violence is and what they can do about it. And the first thing that we tell them to do is to try to get away from that situation. The second thing is we tell them they have to tell somebody. They have to tell and tell and tell until somebody believes them. Because this is a mandated reporting state. That means it is actually, it can be a felony for not reporting. So once an adult even suspects that a child is being abused, he or she is obligated to report it. So that's what it's all about. It's about for the child to understand what it is, tell and keep telling. For an adult, my personal view is that sexual violence of any stripe is like battery acid. If it drips inside, and it'll drip for a lifetime unless you tell the right people. So we also encourage adults to tell. Reporting, we want them to report. We never, ever make them report. But once they do tell somebody, the treatment that happens afterwards is restorative, and everybody has the potential of being helped and hoped and healed.
What are the barriers that people feel, whether they be children or adults, to actually making that call or getting themselves down to get help?
I think out of all the various reasons for not reporting, probably for me, what I have seen over the years that I've been doing this work, is people sense that others won't believe them. There's still a lot of shame around this, and that's what we battle every day at the Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center. This shouldn't be a dirty little secret. This is a crime. And this is a crime against them for which they are not responsible. So among the many barriers is the fact that it's difficult to say the words to report. It is difficult to come forward on any level. So that's what we work at all the time. We want people to understand that it's not their fault and they can be helped.
We're talking to Barbara Goldman, who's the director of the Santa Fe Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center. How bad is the problem in New Mexico?
It's real bad. According to the latest statistics, we are third in the United States of America for reported rapes per capita. But I also want to say, I always have to add an addendum to that, and that is that that's
third in the United States.
That's correct. But that's not necessarily as bad as it seems. It's a skewed statistic because that's reported rapes. And if it's an indication that more people are reporting, then that's a good statistic.
So you think that in other places the numbers are really much higher because people aren't reporting?
I think that that's probably true. I think that what you're seeing here in the state of New Mexico is A, we're a mandated reporting state, and B, we have rape crisis centers across the state of New Mexico that are flexing a lot of muscle. We have coordinated services, and I think people are understanding that people will believe them if they do come forward.
So actually, that's really a testament to the good work of the Rape Crisis Center, that there's just been so much education about it.
Exactly. Not just education, but proactivism. We have an advocacy core of people who are umbilically connected to the survivors from the minute they come in till the minute they're ready to exit the legal system. We are there for them. That's all we do. And all of our services are offered free of charge.
Carol Horwitz is the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Liaison for the City of Santa Fe, and you are working on something called the Safe Haven Project. What is that?
Okay, this is a really exciting project, and it grew out of our Faith Summit on Domestic and Sexual Violence that we had last year. And what had happened was one of our presenters was talking about another city in which he had lived where they had a Safe Haven program going, and it was... I think it was primary. It was like a block captain or block chairman, Safe Children Coming Home from School project. And Barbara and I brainstormed about this, and we decided, let's do this for victims of domestic and sexual and dating violence. And so this is really exciting because Esperanza, Rape Crisis, and myself, really interested advocates in the community came together. We designed a training program. What is it? What are the tools that we can give ordinary people to help them help survivors? So we were thinking in terms of businesses or churches or different agencies in town, health departments, doctor's offices. What are the tools that we can give them that will help them help a person right then, right there? And so we developed this a PowerPoint training project. It takes about an hour and a half, maybe even 2 hours with questions and answers, depends on the group. We rolled it out at Vanessi's on Thursday for Health and Human Services Week. And we are hoping that every single business in town will get on board with this. Once they get the training, they get a big, beautiful sticker for their door that says, "This is if you are a victim of sexual, domestic, or dating violence, you are safe here." Then the staff inside the business or the agency has been trained on some very simple things that they can do to help that person.
Like what?
Well, one thing they can do is believe them. They can ask the person whether or not they want help. If they want help, they have a list of referrals that they can provide them. They do some sort of first-line troubleshooting in the situation. If it's a child, once again, we're a mandatory reporting state, so there's phone numbers for mandatory reporting.
And let me just say what's very cool about this project. I just love the fact that sexual violence and domestic violence can be one of the most isolating crimes ever committed against a person. The survivor of those kinds of violence, they feel like nobody cares, nobody understands. So what we're doing is kind of mobilizing and activating the business community. This is like a whole community's response against a really horrific crime. And it's just, I get very passionate about this because to have an entire community awake and aware about what this is, what it means, and what they can do, it's extraordinary. I think it's one of the most meritorious programs in the whole city.
I think one of the great changes we've seen is going from sort of women-only space and women helping other women to this being a really intergender thing, men and women both being educated and trained, men and women both being aware of the abuse that happens to themselves and the others, and men being part of the healing, and it's not just about women.
Oh, well said. Absolutely. Absolutely. More and more at the Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center, we are engaging systemically men in what we're doing. And one of the events that we're having as a testimonial to this, on May the 24th, we're going to be having the testosterone testimonials. And yes, I said it over the airwaves. It's the testosterone testimonials. It's going to be at the James A. Little Theater. And we have selected men of really good intent, men who have mouths and aren't afraid to use those mouths to end sexual violence. They're going to be presenting their own testimonials about what it is like living with testosterone in these troubled times. It's kind of a, you know, an adjunct to the vagina monologues. So we're very excited. And by the way, any woman who brings 3 men with her to this event gets in for free.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that's a good deal.
That is indeed. We're talking to Barbara Goldman and Carol Horowitz. So everybody lives with testosterone. Women have it too. Men have it too.
Dr. Horowitz, I'll turn that question over to you.
Well, actually, I want to talk about something else.
Okay.
The other thing that we're doing as part of National Sexual Violence Awareness Month, and then we can talk about testosterone.
Yeah,
we
don't
out
really
of time.
Have to. Go ahead.
But one of the things that came to my attention at a National Organization for Women meeting was that one of the women at the meeting lives in the Camino Jacobo Housing Trust. There's a large chain link fence there between the houses, and there's a big field in front of the new Lowe's that's over there in Cerritos Road. And that field is full of very unsavory activity. And the women there are just have been really terrorized by people in those fields, yelling at them and screaming at them. And we had tried during National Domestic Violence Awareness Month to get funds together to build a privacy fence there. But we didn't succeed. But we do have the materials now. And so on Saturday at 10 a.m., we're meeting at Camino Jacobo. Representatives from Esperanza, representatives from Rape Crisis, representatives from National Organization for Women, the Boy Scouts, members of the Camino Jacobo housing community, and we're going to have pizzas from Trader Joe's, and we're going to build that privacy fence. We're actually weaving those plastic slats into the fence, and the women over there are so excited to have that barrier. Because no matter how much the police patrol that field, they can't be there 24 hours a day. It's just impossible. And every time a woman turns on her porch light at night, she is just like in the spotlight. So this is really going to help make those women feel safer. And we're really excited about this project. It's open to the community. Can I give my phone number? 955-5018. 955-5018 if you want to join us, and this is, you know, kind of walking your talk, making this community safer for each other. That's what we're doing.
And by the way, that's the same phone number that people can call if they are business owners and would like to have Safe Haven come to their shop.
Right.
We're ready to go.
It's ready to go, and it's, once again, it's a free training. Once they receive the training, they get this beautiful decal. They get all the support from Rape Crisis and from Esperanza. They get lots of information. They get a poster to put by the telephone, so they have information on who to call and the simple questions that they can ask possible survivors.
And just to make it really clear, we're not about training people to be therapists or even advocates, but just responsible citizens who give a damn about this.
And when we're speaking of advocates, we should say that the Rape Crisis Center does have a hotline that people can call 24 hours a day.
Absolutely.
And what is that number?
986-9111.
986-9111. So that people can call that any time of day or night if they have... I mean, I know people who've called that who were just experiencing really bad memories of something that had happened to them at an earlier time, and there was a sympathetic voice at the other end of the phone.
Sympathetic and well-trained voice at the other end, and say that we're open 24/7, 365. People don't need an appointment to walk in. Our therapists stand ready. We have wonderful clinicians. So anybody in your listening audience who has just been thinking about doing this, they should activate themselves and get in, because it's a place of healing and it's a place of hope and health. So we anxiously await people who need our help.
Now, you have all sorts of sexual abuse prevention programs, and I think one of the things that's interesting is the question of how do you make children aware of the reality of sexual assault or people, you know, going over the line in one way or another without freaking them out about sex, which is a natural and wonderful thing.
Exactly. Couldn't agree with you more on the latter
and
the former. It's an art. It really is an art and a skill. And the folks from our outreach and education programs who go out into the schools know how to relate to children without scaring them. This is just about information. This is just about, in the same way that you would teach your child to look both ways when they cross the street, that's what we talk about when we go in. Here's what you need to do. Here's how it works when you're looking both ways about taking care of yourself. And it's done interactively, it's done on their level, and it's done with some remarkable life-size, kindergarten life-size puppets, so that the entire approach is child-centered, child-oriented, culturally aware, and we're very, very careful to make them understand that they have power, and they know how to do certain things that can help them, and there is power in telling. So we never frighten them, ever, and we give them ample opportunity to interact with us, so that they feel very comfortable. And that's what it's all about. And also we involve the teachers and the counselors and the nurses at the schools as well. And parents are always invited to come in, because, you know, if we want this to work, it has to work not just at school but at home as well.
There's some strange things that come out of it, though, I have to say. I was once, a couple of years ago, in the grocery store, and there was this like 12-year-old girl blocking the aisle, and I tapped her on the shoulder so I could get my cart through. She went to her mother and said, "That lady touched me," and her mother chewed me out, like yelled at me like a crazy banshee in the middle of the supermarket. And I was like, the writing was on the wall. This child had taken a course at school that said that if any stranger touches you, go tell your mother. And I'd like tap the girl on the shoulder. So there's a lot of weird misinterpretation that can come of this stuff as well.
I don't know if that's a majority response.
I know it's not a majority response.
Exactly. Well, that's a kid who has been hypersensitized about it, and that's something that I will take back to my agency and talk about, because we talk about good touch and bad touch, and tapping somebody on the shoulder is certainly not a bad touch. Could lead to bad touching, but it is not a bad touch. So maybe we need, when we go back, to emphasize more of what's the good touch.
We're talking to Barbara Goldman and Carol Horowitz. How sensitive do you think you work, Carol, with the police force of Santa Fe? How sensitive are our city's cops to sexual assault and to all of these issues?
Well, I think that they're pretty incredible, actually. At the beginning of the month, we did had a dinner to honor. There are four detectives. Well, actually, there's only three right now. They're actually, they live at the Santa Fe Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center. Their offices are there. And they are there. They specialize in sexual assault. They, with adults and with children, they're just incredible. They're very knowledgeable. They're very kind. They're very gentle. And I think that they're really amazing law enforcement officers.
And I want to add to that, because historically and traditionally, rape crisis centers and law enforcement have pretty much a confrontational attitude. It goes on today. Not at this one. I have to tell you that I believe that our police force, or all of law enforcement in the city of Santa Fe, are extraordinary. In the bad old days, they did not know anything about this issue. Now, they're well-trained, they're compassionate, they're passionate about helping survivors of this violence. And I can say that unequivocally. We love working the city of Santa Fe police force. Co-housing in our facility has made all the difference in the world in terms of understanding our own roles and responsibilities and theirs. Those guys, young men and women generally, do an incredible job of doing their job.
Now, how long has that been going on, that they've been co-housed?
7 years, and I'm telling you, it is a gold standard in working for victims. When they come to the Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center, it's one-stop shopping. Under one roof, we have a simultaneous translator, we have the advocacy program, we have three City of Santa Fe police officers, we have the sexual assault nurse examiners, we have a wonderful collaborative relationship with St. Vincent Hospital. There are seven nurses, four pediatric specialists, and three adult specialists. We also have Strongheart Safe House, which is a forensic interviewing service. It's all there under one roof. So the survivor and their families don't have to go from pillar to post getting services. It's all there, and it's free.
So this is all happening at the Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center. I have to say again, you know, having—I don't know whether I end up always on the bad receiving end of some of these things—but I had a sort of horrible incident happen to me about 4 years ago. I called 911. The policeman came, didn't believe me. Didn't believe me.
Well, let me say something about that. There is training that is going on continuously with our law enforcement officers. And I have to say, Mary Charlotte, when I started at the police department, I was very nervous because to me, law enforcement were the people behind me on the highway when I was going 85,
right,
and they were writing me the tickets. And I have to say that since I've been there, I have found that 99.9% of law enforcement officers are in that profession because they like to help people. And I know every single one of us, we have maybe had an experience with that 1/10 of 1%, but don't let that cloud your vision.
Well, I wondered if they had been trained to do interrogation and screen out people who had been, you know, taking drugs or whatever. But basically, I was accused of making it up, dreaming, or taking drugs. And I thought, I wonder if that's just how they're trained.
Was this a sexual violence incident?
Yeah.
I mean, that's astounding to hear that. And I can bet you my friend Carol ain't going to let that one lie. She's going to go right back.
It's old news now, but
no,
anyway.
No, it's never old news. It's
anyway,
yeah. So
all this and much, much more.
what I want to say is that that phone number, 955-5018, if you ever, ever, ever have a bad experience, sometimes, you know, people do call me, they've had a bad experience, and then what I do is I go and I either talk to that law enforcement officer, find out what his or her training needs are, or I talk to their commander, or I talk to the chief of police. So I can take concerns from citizens, and I can operate on them right away, and I have done that for a lot of different people. Not that it happens every day, but every time it happens, I follow up on it every single time.
Carol Horowitz is domestic violence and sexual assault liaison for the city of Santa Fe. Barbara Goldman is the director of the Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center. The hotline, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is 986-9111. And to reach Carol and for the Safe Haven Project, you can call 955-5018. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can leave me a message at radiocafe@ksfr.org by email or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org where you can hear the show anytime you want thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.